For this special episode of the podcast, we are pleased to share with you a talk given by Dr. James K.A. Smith at OKC First earlier this week, titled Faith, Doubt, and the Limits of Knowing, Lessons from St. Augustine. Jamie is professor of philosophy at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan, as well as the author of numerous books about Christian theology and spirituality that have shaped the way we think about God, our neighbors, and ourselves here at OKC First. These works include Desiring the Kingdom, You Are What You Love, How Not to Be Secular, and his most recent work, On the Road with St. Augustine, A Real-World Spirituality for Restless Hearts. Dr. Smith spoke both at OKC First and in chapel at Southern Nazarene University this week, and we are grateful to Dr. Ron Wright, Dr. Blair Spindle, and the SNU Science and Religion Club for making his visit to Oklahoma City possible. We hope you enjoy this special episode.
So I want to share with you from a new book of mine called On the Road with St. Augustine. But I don't want to presume that you know who St. Augustine is or that you know it's pronounced St. Augustine. And so I want to give you just a little bit of a biographical context so then I can sort of plop you into his story and narrative here and you won't feel too discombobulated. How many of you have heard of St. Augustine or St. Augustine before? Okay. Oh, okay. Great. Fantastic. So just as a rehearsal and reminder, St. Augustine is an ancient figure who lives in the late 300s and early 400s. So a long time ago, right? And yet my claim is that Augustine is our contemporary. Like there's something about the way Augustine understands the world and understands himself that has a lot to say to us in the 21st century. Another very important feature of Augustine's biography is that he is from North Africa, what would be today contemporary Algeria. So he grew up just off the coast of Africa. At that time, so think 300s, 400s, when are we? Roman Empire. At that time, North Africa is a province of the Roman Empire, and the biggest city in that provincial region, so he's a provincial, the biggest city in that region is Carthage. And so Carthage is kind of the university town nearby, but then eventually Augustine was basically a kind of, I said to the group earlier, he was kind of a Cornell frat boy who wanted to work in D.C., That's Augustine, okay? And so and he lives that story. So he lives the frat boy life, but he's also super smart, and then he lands good jobs, and he climbs his way eventually to Rome. And then eventually, at this time, actually, the emperor's seat is not in Rome. It's in Milan, up north, pre-coronavirus. And Augustine eventually gets the job in Milan and is literally the speechwriter for the emperor. Okay, so he makes it to the very pinnacle of that experience. He writes a very, very famous book called The Confessions. Okay, so Augustine's Confessions is one of the great spiritual classics of the West. It is his story of basically looking for love in all the wrong places until he's found in Christ, right? And how that reconfigures his life. There's one other thing I wanted to tell you as an important piece of context. Oh, after he becomes a Christian in Milan. After he becomes a Christian, he returns to Africa and never leaves again. He's ordained a priest. He's eventually basically pressured into becoming a bishop. And it remains the rest of his life as a bishop and also goes on to become the greatest doctor of the church after Paul. So it's kind of Jesus, Paul, Augustine. Interestingly, by the way, so I'm telling you more than you need to know. I do have a talk to give. Augustine is in many ways the patron saint of the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation. So he's also, the thing I guess I love about St. Augustine, he is a bridge-building character between Protestants and Catholics. We both look back, we all look back to Augustine as a doctor, a teacher for us. The thing that I love about the Confessions is it's a deeply human book, and he's really sort of making himself vulnerable so you can hear what was going on when he was looking for love in all the wrong places. That's really what the Confessions is about. So what I want to do tonight is I actually want to consider the way into the question of wisdom and doubt and the limits of knowing is to actually consider what Augustine thought education was for. Because think of all, there are all kinds of idols in our lives and even in our contemporary culture, and I would say education is still a live idol, right? For some people, what is an education other than a way to realize and get to the emperor's palace, so to speak? So that's where we're going to start. Is that okay? Is that helpful? It's probably more than you want to know. So here's our question. What is an education for? If you're an aspiring provincial like Augustine, an education often looks like a ladder. That is, an education is really just a tool for climbing. And sadly, I think we live in an age in which the university has adopted that picture of itself. So colleges are reduced to credential factories, and the Ivy League is basically a ridiculously expensive employment agency that connects the new meritocracy with hedge funds and Supreme Court clerkships. It's all just so we're just placing people. The university in this case isn't actually about knowledge and wisdom. It's about attainment. It's about leveraging information for the sake of achievement. In other words, not too much has changed since a young Augustine made his way to Carthage in the 4th century, where study was actually a distraction from all the extracurricular activities. And learning itself was instrumentalized as a means to achieve some other good. When Augustine's looking back on this period in his life, in the Confessions, here's what he says. My studies, which were deemed respectable, had the objective of leading me to distinction as an advocate in the law courts, where one's reputation is high in proportion to one's success in deceiving people. So the liberal arts in Augustine's experience were something to be weaponized rather than a curriculum for cultivating the soul. The notion that his university education might actually touch on matters of wisdom was almost laughable. None of us are here for wisdom. We're here to climb to the next level. But, of course, even broken clocks are right twice a day. And even a resisted curriculum can be a portal to another world. In a university that revolves around the quest for profit and prestige or just sheer pragmatism, a lingering liberal arts curriculum can be like a distant echo that keeps calling. So you never know when the still small voice of Plato can pierce through the noise in a marauding frat boy's life and resound as a wake-up call that he has a soul. Or how the mysteries of physics might prod an otherworldly pietist to attend to the goodness of God's creation right in front of her. There's a kind of learning that doesn't just position you, but transforms you. There's a pursuit of knowledge that isn't just a stepping stone to some other goal, but is actually a kind of investigation of creation that adds something to the beauty of the world. This is the kind of wake-up call that jostled Augustine. I should tell you also, I'm a philosopher by training, so philosophy gets a lot of credit in here, but that's not me making it up. That's Augustine's own testimony. It's going to be interesting. Listen for the way in which, for Augustine, philosophy was kind of I was going to say gateway drug, which seems an unfortunate metaphor. It was an entree to the gospel. So the wake-up call that jostled Augustine happened at university almost accidentally. In the seething cauldron, the seething carnal cauldron of Carthage, I mean, it's totally UNC. Do you know what I mean? Have any of you ever heard of a novel by Thomas Wolfe called I Am Charlotte Simmons? It's this remarkable display that tells you the university is hardly ever about education, and it's all about experiencing things with your body. For so many people, that's what the university education is like. It turns out the University of Carthage exactly the same way. In fact, Augustine says his fellow students took vandalism more seriously than their studies. Nonetheless, at university, Augustine was assigned to read an ancient Roman philosopher named Cicero. And in that reading, we really witness his first conversion. He read this little work by Cicero called the Hortensius, which is like an exhortation, a call. And it's an exhortation to pursue wisdom. And reading this kind of caught Augustine off guard and set him off kilter. It plucked strings in his soul that he didn't even know he had. The book changed my feelings, he recalled. It altered my prayers to be towards you yourself. It gave me different values and priorities. Suddenly, every vain hope became empty to me, and I longed for the immortality of wisdom with an incredible ardor in my heart. I'm still waiting for a student in my intro class to give me that evaluation after they read Plato, you know? So what I would say is for the next decade, so this is as a young man, probably late teens, for the next decade, Augustine lives what contemporary philosopher Charles Taylor would call a cross-pressured existence. This notion, Taylor has this notion that we, in a secular age, we inhabit this kind of cross-pressured existence where we feel pushed and pulled and tugged by all these rival ideas in our experience. And that was very much Augustine's experience. He felt pulled in all these different directions because he was this rogue, this frat boy, who nonetheless had caught the philosophy bug. So a new interest and curiosity has been kindled, but old habits and hungers remain alive and well. Philosophy became something to be added to his life. It didn't actually become a way of life. And in fact, it's remarkable how philosophy, the alleged love of wisdom, philosophia, philo, the love of Sophia, wisdom, it's a remarkable how philosophy, the alleged love of wisdom, can be domesticated by these other lingering habits of the heart, such that philosophy just becomes one more lust, one more game of domination and conquest. I can't tell you how many sophomore philosophy majors I've seen who really don't care about wisdom yet. They just care about winning the argument. The encounter with Cicero's Hortensius birthed something new in Augustine, but his infant interest in wisdom became the child that was still served by other masters ruling his heart. Now, interestingly, this is where I think he gives us a little tool that we can use. Augustine would give a name to this kind of disordered relationship to wisdom and learning. It's a Latin term, curiositas. Curiositas. Now, you hear an English word in that, curiosity. Now, one of the problems with just translating this simply curiosity is for us, curiosity is a good thing, right? To be inquisitive, to be wondering. For Augustine, curiositas is not the spirit of inquiry that we prize and encourage. Rather, curiositas is his name for a kind of quest for knowledge that doesn't know what it's for, okay? So curiositas is the opposite of wisdom. Curiositas is a quest for knowledge that doesn't know what it's for. It's a knowing for knowing's sake, we might say, or maybe actually more to the point, we could say it is knowing for the sake of being known as someone who knows. Can you feel the difference there? So it's not that I want to know so that I can be wise. I want to know so that you know that I know, and I get to be seen as somebody in the know. For Augustine, in curiositas, the reason I want to know is an indicator of the sort of love that motivates my learning. The reason I want to know is an indicator of the sort of love that motivates my learning. Am I learning in order to grow, learning in order to know who and how to love? Am I digging into the nooks and crannies of the world in order to understand the beauty of its creator and serve my fellow creatures? Or am I learning in order to wield power, to get noticed, to be seen as smart, to be the one who's in the know? The disordered love of learning, curiositas, makes you a mere technician of information for some end other than wisdom. And of course, the irony is that even philosophy could devolve into that, another way of idolizing. So curiositas is characterized by what you might call the sort of fetishization of something as truth in order to serve my own interests and ends. It's really a self-serving endeavor. So when learning is reduced to curiositas, actual truth and wisdom are disdained as an affront to my interests, my authority, my autonomy. And I become someone for whom, Augustine says, actual truth engenders hatred. Does that sound like a phenomenon you can identify with or see in someone? Here's Augustine's diagnosis of this. And I want to read one paragraph, which I think is, it feels really timely. All right, listen to what Augustine says. These are people who are characterized by curiositas, which he's saying was him. Their love for truth takes the form that they love something else and want this object of their love to be the truth. And because they do not wish to be deceived, they do not wish to be persuaded that they are mistaken. And so they hate the truth for the sake of the object which they love instead of the truth. They love the truth for the light it sheds, but hate when it shows them up as being wrong. There's a kind of selective relationship to truth here that characterizes curiositas. It looks like you care about knowing, but you actually care about knowing things that serve your own interests, that never decenter you or displace you. What masquerades as the pursuit of truth becomes an agenda for confirming my biases and making me comfortable. If the actual truth comes in and disrupts my enjoyment, I resent the truth all the more. So what I love in this case is my truth, not the truth. Now, before we comfort ourselves thinking, yeah, those dang liberals, there are very pious Christian versions of this same thing. Very pious Christian versions of the same thing. So curiositas generates, interestingly, its own frenetic anxiety. Because now I have to keep up and stay in the know, because that's the whole reason I'm knowing. I have to keep striving to be the person who knows before everybody else. There's a great episode of Portlandia that you have to look up. If you just Google Portlandia over, there's this episode where it's like, oh, this is you know, have you been to this place? Have you listened to this band? Have you eaten at this restaurant? Or like, oh yeah, that was so 5 minutes ago. Oh yeah, we did that last. We're over it. We're over that. Now it's like, oh my gosh, the exhaustion of always having to be on the vanguard of knowing what's the best thing. That's the exhaustion of being perpetually in the know, which is a terrible, terrible experience, which explains why this sort of pursuit of truth doesn't ever feel like the beata vita, the happy life that we should be pursuing in wisdom. To be among the enlightened ones, which is the same thing, right? Like we're the ones who know. Well, now the price of being among the enlightened one is all this anxiety of being found out, of not knowing, of being in the out-group of the ignorant rather than the inner sanctum of winks and nods and inside jokes. So curiositas is the anxious burden of always having to be clever. Now, if this early encounter with Cicero's Hortensius woke something up in Augustine, it wasn't quite true philosophia, love of wisdom, but rather a lust for knowledge that served other cravings, for advancement and access to an inner circle. He wasn't really interested in wisdom. He simply wanted to be part of the enlightened crowd. Do you see the difference? This was still, actually, now what's going on here? It's really a craving to belong, which is a good craving. The question is how you belong, which perfectly explains why, not long after this wake-up call, Augustine falls in with this crazy sect group called the Manichaeans. Now, okay, let me pause for a second. Let me go Steve Tyler here. Because I feel like you're not hearing me very well. So maybe I should hold this. So the Manichaean, when I was working on this book on Augustine, the Manichaeans are huge, factor hugely in Augustine's story, but what they believe is so crazy and weird and like ancient and unbelievable. I'm like, what on earth do the Manichaeans have to do with us? Until I realized that actually the parallel isn't what the Manichaeans believed, it was how they claimed to know. So let me, so this, just as a proviso, and then I'll dive back in. The Manichaeans were this kind of weird sect that revolved around the teachings of Mani, M-A-N-I, who were kind of, they were astrologers who believed that reading the stars gave them insights into human fate. They also had, just in case this is going to come up, they also had this total secret society thing going on, where basically when you wanted to join the Manichaeans, first you're kind of in the outer circle, and then you work your way into the inner circle, and then you eventually hope to become one of the elect. Don't blame Calvinists for this. This is like, this was the sort of inner sanctum, okay? This, so what was going on? Why would somebody like Augustine, who really had this philosophy bug wake up call, why would he, and why would he all of a sudden fall in with this group that seemed kind of crazy? Well, this detour in Augustine's journey and his lifelong wrangling with them will seem hopelessly irrelevant to 21st century seekers if we merely consider the Manichaeans, these devotees of Mani, but what they believed. The teachings of Mani are so foreign and fantastical that they don't seem to have any contemporary analog. It's not like people are tempted to become Manichaeans today. Although astrology is back in really, really weird ways. Let's talk about it later. The cosmology, the belief system of the Manichaeans is more like Star Wars than anything. It's like this light dark thing, evil forces going on. It's kind of crazy, and it feels like more like Game of Thrones. So nobody really would believe this. However, we need to look past the content of the Manichaeans' doctrine and see what actually drew Augustine in is the way they claimed to know. What's instructive about Augustine's attraction to Manichaeanism is less what they taught and more how they held to that teaching. In this respect, you'll notice something shockingly contemporary about the Manichaeans' epistemic posture. In fact, and this will sound crazy, but the Manichaeans were really the rationalists of their day. They were the rationalists of their day. Let me explain. While their worldview seems fantastical to us, the Manichaeans prided themselves on having escaped superstition and the embarrassment of having to believe. The way, like basically, the Manichaeans drew people in and said, look, everybody else believes something. If you come to us, you will know. So you overcome the naivete of believing, and if you come to us, you get the enlightenment of knowing. While they're, instead of arriving at the shore, sorry, what they would do is promise that you would get to the shore of enlightened knowledge. Indeed, it's not a stretch to say that the Manichaeans actually considered themselves the scientists of meaning in their day. Because, think of it, I mean, we think of astrology as like, ooh, but they think they're reading the stars. They think they're the astronomers of meaning. So they had this kind of scientific posture of sorts, and instead of trusting the testimony of prophets, their knowledge was rooted in the course of the sun, moon, and stars. So these purveyors of light, as they called themselves, of secret enlightenment, were the brights of their day. They prided themselves on refusing authority and instead knowing how things worked. The attraction, then, was less to explanatory power and more the association with people who confidently imagined they had an explanation for everything. And I should add, somehow the Manichaeans were very well-connected people. In fact, it was the Manichaeans who got Augustine his first job in Rome and also got him his imperial appointment. So it's a little bit like sort of East Coast, Coast elites. Do you know what I mean? Like there's this sort of network where they're the ones who, you know, they castigate the flyover states where people believe in God, and they're the rationalists. And by also, by the way, we will hook you up with power. So the attraction of the Manichaeans was an intertwined set of benefits that spoke directly to this aspiring provincial, running from his mother's backwater faith, newly interested in being in the know, and still clamoring for positions of power and influence. The attraction to Manichaeanism was about association with people who confidently offered a posture as much as any doctrine. In fact, Augustine later writes an old friend of his, after Augustine has sort of extricated him from the Manichaeans and made his way to Christian faith, he has a dear friend, Honoratus, who is still in the Manichaean sect, and he's writing him letters trying to sort of draw him out of it. And he says, "We fell in with them," he reminds Honoratus, "because they promised a way to rise above those held in fear by superstition." Who would not be enticed by promises like that, Augustine says. This is a familiar recipe for recruitment, trotted out today by rationalist purveyors of scientism, not science, but scientism, who promise to unlock all the mysteries of the universe by a science that shows there are none. From Richard Dawkins to Steven Pinker, the priests of enlightenment are prophets of overreach, promising a status more than an actual explanation. And we buy in less because the system works intellectually. In fact, we often don't even really test the claims. We actually trust them. And we get drawn in more because it comes with the allure of illumination and sophistication, with the added benefit of throwing off the naivete of our parents' simplistic faith. What their knowledge offers is really a shortcut to respectability. This is a recipe for a lot of sort of exits from faith. The thing is, you just have to be careful not to ask too many questions once you make it inside. And interestingly, this was Augustine's problem. So what happened was, he's sort of apprenticing himself to the Manichaeans. But Augustine is wicked smart, okay? And has all of these questions. And he's got this philosophical rumbling. And so he keeps asking the Manichaeans these questions that they don't have answers for. And so they keep telling him, wait till Faustus comes. Faustus is now the new teacher. Wait till Faustus comes. Okay, wait till your father gets home, kind of thing. Wait till Faustus comes. Well, Augustine waits patiently, gets his audience with Faustus. Very disappointed with Faustus. It's like you get to the curtain in Oz and you peek behind and you're like, are you freaking kidding me? This is the best that's behind? This is what's going on behind the curtain? And so he's utterly deflated. Augustine pulls the rug out from the feigned stance of rational self-sufficiency. So later, and this is where I hope this feels like it has some contemporary relevance. When Augustine now looks back on this experience, and he's commending the Christian faith again with new eyes, he actually points out that, well, you know, I should just read my notes. They're not bad. When Augustine criticizes the Manichaeans later, what he does is he pulls the rug out from under their feigned stance of rational self-sufficiency. Everyone believes, he points out, everyone believes. Everyone submits to some authority. And all these people priding themselves on enlightenment have decided to simply trade belief in one set of authorities for belief in another set of authorities. They haven't graduated from trusting some authority. They've just swapped. Credulity, believing, Augustine points out, is not a defect. Credulity is not a defect. In fact, he says, it's inherent to being human. Trust is the oxygen of human society, Augustine says. And believing the testimony of others is actually at the very heart of the scientific enterprise. There is no science without believing the testimony of others. So understanding doesn't transcend belief. It relies on belief. If someone says believing is wrong, like the Manichaeans did, Augustine says, like rationalists always do, Augustine says this: if somebody says believing is wrong, I do not think he can have any friends. If it's wrong to believe anything, then either one does wrong by believing a friend, or one never believes a friend. And then I don't see how you can call either oneself or the friend a friend. What is friendship other than trust? Believing. So Augustine is striking at the very heart of what the Manichaeans offered, which wasn't just enlightenment, but belonging. In a circle of those in the know, this friendship of light. But Augustine isn't promising some other self-sufficient enlightenment to counter what the Manichaeans are offering. He's calling into question the very myth of their stance. The question isn't whether you're going to believe, but who. It's not merely about what to believe, it's about who are you going to entrust yourself to. Do you really want to trust yourself? That's what rationalism is ultimately saying. We trust ourselves. Do we really think humanity is our best bet? Do we really think we are the answer to our problems when we're the ones who created all the problems? The problem with everything from enlightenment scientism to mushy eat, pray, loveism is us. We're the problem in all of those scenarios. If anything looks irrational, it's the notion that we are our own best hope. So Augustine invites Honoratus, this friend he's trying to draw back, to consider what's at the heart of Christianity, which is not a teaching per se, but an event. An unthinkable event from a Manichaean perspective, and yet one that speaks to humanity's deepest hungers and fears. Here's how Augustine puts it in his letter. Since, therefore, we had to model ourselves on a human being, but not set our hopes on a human being, could God have done anything kinder or more generous than for the real, eternal, unchanging wisdom of God himself, to which we must cling, to condescend to take on human form? By this miraculous birth and his deeds, he won our love. But by his death and resurrection, he drove out fear. Many years later, in 417, still confronting the challenge of the Manichaeans' rationalism, Augustine pleads with his congregation in a sermon. And you can feel the kind of like pleading sincerity. In the sermon, he says, "You cannot be your own light. You can't. You simply can't. We are in need of enlightenment. We are not the light. You're going to entrust yourself to somebody. Would you entrust yourself to the one who gave himself for you?" Now, there's no rush. I think one of the other beautiful things about Augustine's story, if you remember that we're seeing years, decades of his running and God's patience the whole way. It took Augustine a long time before he'd actually consider what he's saying now. His disenchantment with the false promises of the Manichaeans did not translate into an immediate embrace of Christianity. In fact, the result was a long period of destabilizing skepticism. And he really became sympathetic to skeptics and cynics, so that by the time he arrives in Milan, he almost despairs whether there is truth, whether he can know anything is true. I think it's important that we recognize that our cerebral struggles are often intertwined with other anxieties. What we identify as intellectual barriers are sometimes manifestations of emotional blocks. So we pride ourselves on being rational, but then miss the biases and blind spots that constitute our rationality. We decide that something, quote, doesn't make sense anymore, when we no longer want to be associated with the people who believe it. Or we say a light goes on and we see something after we've spent time hanging out with people who believe it. Rationality turns out to be a lot more malleable than we'd guess. In fact, sometimes plausibility, believability, is pegged to a person. This is the turning point for Augustine. It wasn't an argument. It was a guy named Ambrose. What Ambrose said, Ambrose was the Bishop of Milan at the time that Augustine arrives there. He was really one of the sort of powerhouse intellectuals of the day, and he was a Christian, and he was a priest and a preacher. Augustine didn't think you could put those things together. He didn't think you could be both smart and a Christian. What Ambrose said, what Ambrose taught and preached, was not insignificant, but what made a dent on Augustine's imagination was Ambrose's very being, what he represented in his way of life. Ambrose was like a living icon of someone who integrated assiduous learning with ardent Christian faith. If to that point, based on his childhood experience, Augustine had concluded that Christians were simple and backward and backwater and naive, the encounter with Ambrose was the destabilizing experience of meeting someone with intellectual firepower who was also following Jesus. But even more than that, it was Ambrose's hospitality that prompted Augustine to reconsider the faith he'd rejected as unenlightened. What ultimately shifted Augustine's plausibility structures? It's love. It was love. His recollection of Ambrose is warm and speaks to a hunger even more fundamental than the intellectual. This is to me, one of the most beautiful sentences in all of the Confessions. He's talking about Ambrose. He says this: "That man of God took me up as a father takes a newborn baby in his arms. And in the best tradition of bishops, he prized me as a foreign sojourner." It's a beautiful, beautiful testimony. More than arguments or proofs, Ambrose offered the seeker Augustine something he'd been hungering for, which was really a home, a sanctuary, rest. For this refugee in a new city, arriving with questions and so much unsettled in his life, the cathedral in Milan became an outpost of the home this spiritual refugee had been seeking. And there was a father there waiting to welcome him. For Augustine, the story of the prodigal son is the most organizing road trip for making sense of our spiritual journeys. This was the point he would later make in a little known work that probably many of us have never heard of called The Advantage of Believing. Now, can you hear how that's a directly counter-Manichaean argument? The advantage of believing. Here's what he says. The point is that there is a relationality to plausibility. Illumination depends on trust, and enlightenment is communal. It's not that Augustine immediately comes to affirm the Catholic faith. Rather, Ambrose's kindness and hospitality to this precocious outsider was the affective condition for him to reconsider the faith he'd learned. Again, here's Augustine on Ambrose. "I fell in love with him, as it were. Not at first as a teacher of the truth, as at that point I had no hope that whatsoever was in your church, but simply as a person who was kind to me." You can feel in this encounter something of the gratitude also of this African outsider not being marginalized by this intellectual at the center of power. He was welcomed. It's not that he immediately comes to believe, but that Christianity becomes more and more believable. "Though now I hadn't yet verified that the church was teaching the truth," he admits, "it was plainly not teaching what I'd so obnoxiously accused it of teaching." What he's saying is, once he met Ambrose, and Ambrose was kind and welcomed him, he realized he couldn't keep repeating the caricatures of Christianity that he'd gotten away with before. From Ambrose, Augustine would realize that the Christianity he'd rejected was not Christianity. But it was Ambrose's love and welcome that created the intellectual space for him to even consider that. The relationship between love and knowing, affection and intellection, would become a hallmark of Augustine's thought for the rest of his life. By constantly emphasizing, the line, "I believe in order to understand," is Augustine's line. But even more subterranean, his point is, "I love in order to know." And maybe I'm loved into knowing. Now, the embrace of Ambrose doesn't magically smother the questions. There's no dichotomy, only a priority. Not love instead of understanding, but loving in order to understand. If Ambrose engendered a shift in plausibility structures for Augustine, it meant that he could consider anew whether Christianity had resources to answer some of his oldest, most lingering questions. Questions about evil, for example, that plagued him his whole life. Questions about the nature of God, about free will, all kinds of intellectual questions that continued to dog him. The relationship to Ambrose nudged him to find now an intellectual well in Christianity that he didn't know was there before, like he was tapping into an artesian aquifer that had been right under his feet all the way back to Africa. He just hadn't really ever entertained it. He hadn't gone drilling for it. Now, oh gosh, sorry, I'm talking too long. Let me skip ahead to the good parts. So let me. I'll summarize one thing, and then I'll close with the last section. In Book 7 of Augustine's Confessions, he then tells us another important moment. So first of all, there's so much I want to tell you. So Book 8 of the Confessions is usually this sort of, conversion moment that everybody celebrates in the garden where he hears these children playing this game, tole lege, pick up and read, and he picks up the scriptures and he reads Romans 13 and grace floods his heart and he's converted. Yes. However, really, the Confessions is also a series of little conversions on the way to that ultimate conversion. And Book 7 is another key episode of his intellectual conversion. And the gateway for him here was Platonism, the books of the Platonists, as he calls it. And he says, for him, philosophy, and particularly the philosophy of the Platonists, gave him the resources to be able, it was like they gave him a conceptual toolkit so that he could start working on these intellectual questions, like how he could believe in a God who was immaterial and yet existed, or how he could think about the nature of evil and so on. So he has a lot of positive things to say about philosophy, even though he will also recognize the limits of what Platonism could offer. So he says in a famous passage in Book 7, he says, "It's like when I was reading Plato, I was learning that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." The word there being logos, which is rationality, wisdom. So he says, when I was reading Plato, I feel like I was learning some of the truth of the gospel. What I didn't read in Plato was that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. In Plato, I learned that there was a wisdom, but the Platonists were trying to climb up to it. What I heard in the gospel is that that wisdom came down to us. So instead of ascension and climbing, it was the gift of a condescending God who meets us where we are. For someone who had been drawn, and this becomes at the heart of his understanding of Christianity. Platonism was still always going to be a project of self-realization. I'm smart enough that I can think my way to the One. I'm smart enough that I can climb up to wisdom. It's exactly why the Platonists were scandalized by Christianity, because Christianity said anybody can have wisdom. Anybody can access wisdom because it doesn't depend on your capacity. It depends only on your capacity to receive the gift of wisdom that comes to us in the gracious condescension of God in Christ. For someone who had been drawn to the elitism of enlightenment, who had tried to make it into the exclusive Manichaean club of the elect, who had risen above the masses and who had made it to the top, perhaps what was most scandalous about Christianity was its utter democratization of enlightenment, the way the gospel held out the grace of illumination to any and all. You can actually feel this in a snobby remark that Augustine makes right before his own conversion in the garden. After they hear this story of other people who are converting and becoming Christians, Augustine turns, he says this, "I turned on Alypius and cried out, 'What is wrong with us? What is this that you've heard? Uneducated people are rising up and capturing heaven, and we, with our high culture without any heart, see where we roll in the mud of flesh and blood.' Is it because they are ahead of us that we are ashamed to follow? Can you hear the snobbishness in that? Uneducated people are getting illuminated by Christ. They realize, oh, education isn't what I thought it was. So it wasn't about wisdom as a ladder to climb up to God in my own power. It was realizing that wisdom was a gift in which God climbed down the ladder to us. Let me close here. Augustine's confession, his intellectual stand on this mystery of grace, did not preclude humility. Conviction, I think it's important to remember, conviction is not synonymous with dogmatism. Indeed, one of his last acts as an author was a remarkable project. Augustine became his own critic. What he did at the end of his life is he took the entire, we have like shelves of his works, and Augustine reread all of his own works and then wrote a book called the Retractationes, his retractions. His reconsiderations is another English translation. Basically, he goes through, he reads all of his own books, and he tells everybody where he was wrong. Can you imagine? I would not do that. I'm hoping you won't notice all the places where I was wrong. Augustine not only undertakes that for himself, he then publishes it. He says, here's all the places where I was wrong. I think it is a remarkable testament to his intellectual humility. It's an ancient version of How My Mind Has Changed, in which he entreats his readers to cheer his progress rather than denounce the change as intellectual compromise. Augustine hopes for readers not to take glee in his mistakes, but to appreciate the honesty of his admissions. He says at one point, only an ignorant man will have the hardihood to criticize me for criticizing my own errors. It's an intellectual virtue for Augustine to follow illumination where it leads, even if it means admitting one was wrong. We see him make the same appeal to those who are so confident that Christianity is wrong, or that it's intellectually feeble, and thus something to be abandoned or outgrown. He encourages caution. He says, don't hastily consider the matter settled. He doesn't like, how dare you? He's just like, I understand you have questions. Slow down. And he says this, if you do not grasp what I say and doubt whether it is true, at least make up your mind whether you have any doubt about your doubts. Doubt is a companion of faith. It's a sister. It goes along with faith. It's not antithetical to. The trick is to just also have the wherewithal to doubt your doubts. Sometimes doubting your doubts is the beginning of wisdom. Thanks very much. We have time for conversation. Yeah, yeah, great. What do you want to talk about? Questions, worries, comments? Questions? Yes? Oh, that's a good question. So let's see. He's born in 354. This is probably like, say, 420. So how old is that? 354. I know. 66 years old. So he definitely has his AARP card. And so he's by the way, he kind of works till he dies. He dies in 430. So he's definitely, you know, he's probably not really producing other works at this point, and he's going back to it. And are you curious, do you think there's something to the age at which he does it, or? Yeah. No kidding, right? No kidding. Absolutely. Yes. 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 That's a really good point. I mean, I was such a confident young man. The more, of course, the more you learn, the less you know. Well, not the less you are certain of. less you are dogmatic about. Let's put it that way. Yes. So it makes sense that there's a kind of almost natural humility that sets in just living with the complexity of the world. Yeah. 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 It's a good point. That's a good point. Other questions or are there things that were puzzling or applications we could think about? Sorry, did I fire hose you? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, So I think, this is played out as an intellectual, search and quest for Augustine. And it was, but it's clear at the end that that's almost just a surface presenting reality because there's clearly deeper existential things going on. By the way, for those of you who don't know, so Augustine grows up in this kind of bicultural, biracial home, really. So his father is a Roman pagan and his mother is an African Christian. And his early in the Confessions in book two, Augustine has basically nothing good to say about his father. He says, he bequeathed me nothing that made me human. And if anything, only showed him models of disordered love. And in many ways, I think Augustine is, I don't want to psychologize him or biographize him, but it seems clear to me that the way he responds to Ambrose, and it strikes me that Ambrose is the kind of person who, by the way, is not trying to look like the smartest person in the room. He doesn't have to. He's not anxious about that. He probably is the smartest person in the room, but he realizes that his role is not to be information provider in chief. His role is to be shepherd, father, right? To have that kind of role. And it does seem to me that, this is probably slightly inappropriate, but don't get nervous, not that. So do you know the Jordan Peterson phenomenon? This sort of YouTube guy who, okay, so I don't want to disappoint you. I'm not a fan. So Jordan Peterson is this really, really interesting phenomenon of this kind of pop intellectual who has this YouTube channel in which he basically tells young men to clean their rooms. And that's an oversimplification, but like he basically says like, get your stuff together. You know, here's how to live a flourishing life. Here's 12 rules for living is the title of his book. And it's an explosion. Now I will say with young white men, but it clearly is speaking to this huge gap in their lives. And somebody like this steps into it and knows them and sees them and identifies something that's missing. I think what witness to the gospel looks like right now is much more fundamentally relational than apologetic or intellectual. Not that we can be scared of ideas. It's just that sometimes even people who present it as if they have intellectual questions of the faith, that's really just almost like a protective veneer to say, to cover what are maybe even the things that they don't even know about themselves yet that they're really grappling with. And so I will say in writing the book, when you start a book, you don't always know what it's going to be at the end, and which is half the fun. And I would say the two biggest surprises for me, and I've taught Augustine for 20 years. The two biggest surprises for me were the significance of Monica, his mother, and Ambrose. I somehow, before I was really working on this project, and I teach Augustine's, I've probably taught it, oh God, I don't know. I teach it two courses a semester, every semester for 20 years. And I don't know how I missed the significance of Ambrose in this turn. I think because I'm a philosopher, I'm like, oh, Platonism. Platonism, that was it. And you just miss the beauty of his testimony in that too, I think. Yeah, yeah. I always say Ambrose was kind of the Tim Keller of Milan insofar as, but that actually, That's just the intellectual side of it. It doesn't get to the relational side of it. You know, fun. It's just because I think this is a beautiful story. So Augustine's mother, Monica, after whom, by the way, the city of Santa Monica is named. And if you're ever in Santa Monica, go to the base of Wilshire Boulevard, and there's a statue, beautiful Art Deco statue of Monica praying over the city. It's really, really cool. Augustine, when he ran away from his mother, literally under cover of night to try to get away from her, she's kind of like a Woody Allen character in this story. It's partly because he thinks his mother is simple and backward and embarrassing, to be honest. And he thinks her Christianity is bound up with that. One of the great deconstructions of Augustine's snobbishness is when he comes to Milan and he starts getting close to Ambrose, and this is changing everything. His mother hunts him down. So this is like helicopter parent extraordinaire. And this is like an old woman who has to sail the Mediterranean Sea, you know, and she makes her way, and she finally chases Augustine down in Milan, and it turns out Ambrose falls in love with her. Not romantically, but Ambrose like thinks that she's an absolute saint. And Augustine's like, are you freaking kidding me? But really what it does is it repositions. He realizes he was wrong about his mother. There were things about his mother that he never saw before. And when he now looks at her through Ambrose's eyes, he's utterly humbled. And so then Monica is really kind of the hero of the Confessions. It's a really, really beautiful, beautiful story. Yeah, yeah. Others? Yeah. And you're thinking of that Paul Griffiths book, and I bet you're remembering it better than I am right now. So just refresh. You tell us. No, you go ahead. What is studiousness is? So it's the contrast term to curiosity. And what are some of the features of it?
It's treating things as if they're
different. Yes. Great. Yeah. Beautiful. Beautiful. No, exactly. Yeah, it's funny. I don't talk about studiousness in the book, so it's not fully uploaded for me. But it's a kind of, and it is really the virtue of the one who is genuinely questing for wisdom rather than just to be in the know, right? And there's a discipline to it, right? Like there's still, it's not just like, oh, you follow the whims of what interests you. There's still a discipline of apprenticing yourself to the real. But that comes with, instead of in curiositas, it's like, I want to know something so I can claim it. Whereas in studiousness, I want to investigate something so I can touch it. And there's that gratitude dynamic, which I think is really beautiful. And this is such a powerful framing, I think, for framing what should be distinctive about a Christian university versus another kind of institution, right? If we could start telling these stories. The sad thing, of course, is precisely when even Christian universities fall into offering knowledge for the sake of leverage. And that's how we sell an education. That's kind of heartbreaking to see. Yeah, yeah. Not that that ever happens. Yeah, 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 yeah. You all want to get home and see the Super Tuesday results. I understand. Yes. Yeah, great. Wow, great question. So I would say, the book we're talking about, by the way, is called On the Road with St. Augustine. By early, by often. It is the first book that I wrote with a non-Christian audience directly within my purview. Only because I think that Augustine is a kind of figure who, as this sort of proto-existentialist, and yet ancient enough to be strange, could be a way for somebody to like hear Christianity in a way that they haven't heard it before, but hear somebody offering Christianity in a way that speaks to these perennial hungers and desires and worries and anxieties kind of thing. So this was the first time that, of course, on the one hand, I'm hoping Christians read this to be introduced to a kind of ancient rendition of the faith that feels fresh compared to our sort of tired modern tropes, even though it's speaking to contemporary issues. But I also hope that it would be a book where either somebody who was like... So I actually think there's a lot of people in our culture who are exhausted by secularism's false promises. I actually think there's a lot more people who... you know, the new atheist kind of project is loudest precisely because they realize they're not really winning hearts and minds. People are not really that interested in signing up for that. A few loud, minor sorts of choirs are, but at the end of the day, I actually don't think it's had wide cultural purpose because people still feel like there's a kind of mystery to being human. There's a kind of transcendence that they can't explain away, this hunger for it. And so I actually think there's a lot of people, we're reaching a moment in kind of the secularization of our culture where it could be people are turning to reconsider voices. And in that sense, I think Augustine is an interesting character because he's super smart, and so you couldn't brand him as an anti-intellectual, but he's also dealing with these deep existential questions. So I hoped it could be a book that somebody who was like surprised to find themselves entertaining Christianity could, or a lot of young people who are like on their way out the door, right? Who are exhausted with the forms of Christianity that they know. And by the way, I say this somewhat carefully, but if all I knew was the forms of Christianity that they knew, I would leave too. Do you know what I mean? Like what has happened is they've experienced and been bequeathed such stunted, stilted, dysfunctional forms of Christianity that they are forms of Christianity worth walking away from. But the problem is that's not synonymous with Christianity. They just think it is because they've had this sort of parochial experience. And so then I want them to meet someone like Augustine and like, what? Christians think this way? Or, you know, there's this whole rest of the church that they'd never heard of. All they know is sort of the church of their youth pastor. And they're like, what? There's other ways to be a Christian? And so that was part of, no, I love youth pastors. But it's again, just stretching the plausibility possibilities. So now, whether those audiences are reached is a very, very different question. But I at least wanted the let me put it one more way, then I'll stop rambling. I wanted this to be a book that a non-Christian could overhear and not feel like it was an insider conversation. That's the easiest way to put it. So that it doesn't assume Christian faith. It invites it, it articulates it, but it doesn't assume it. So that you could listen in and be like, oh, that's interesting. And you didn't feel like you were being excluded from the conversation. Yeah, which was a fun exercise for me. That was a new adventure. Yeah. It probably is in many ways. And I will say one of the things I'm most encouraged about is all the emails I get then asking me, what translation of the Confessions do you recommend? I'm like, great. I'm happy to be that gateway. The only thing is the burden of my book is also to say, if you really want to get Augustine and feel the breadth of his own insight into the human condition, it's really important to read beyond the published works like Confessions, City of God, and so on. It's to read the sermons and letters. So one of the things I'm trying to do throughout the book is weave in the sermons and letters where I think you hear the most human Augustine. And human, the Augustine the shepherd, Augustine the pastor, Augustine the counselor, Augustine the activist. So you meet this, and so that, it's still, the spine of it is the Confessions because that's Augustine's biography, but I'm trying to also draw people into these other things. Yeah, that's a great question. Great question. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, what I wish it were was an adventure in exploration where we prize it for the sake of acquiring wisdom and being formed rather than instrumentally as a credential that gets us something else. It's one of the reasons why, look, I'm honestly, except there's a big asterisk here, which is education is expensive. That's a different, slightly different conversation and not unimportant. But I'll say this. People sort of like make fun of philosophy majors who then like go to do coding boot camp afterwards. They're like, well, what? Did you not learn anything at school that now you still have to go get some other technical? It's like, well, no. The point of my philosophy degree in a liberal arts college was not to come out with a job credential. It was to become a certain kind of human being. It's an apprenticeship in being human. And then I can deploy that in all kinds of different vocational sorts of realizations. And yeah, I might ally that with some other kind of technical training or whatever it might be. I just envision education as not so much what I know as learning what I love and how to love, but also learning to value the discipline, the studiousness of being one who has a posture of being receptive to learning. Because then that's a lifelong discipline and habit that you take with you. I think it's interesting. We have an engineering program at Calvin where I teach. And yet because it's embedded in a liberal arts college, all of those engineers have to take philosophy, religion, art history, right? That they take the whole panoply. And a lot of people say, oh, wow, that must be such a distraction from learning engineering. And by the way, probably half of the engineering students also feel that way. Except what's interesting is the testimony afterwards is that when they go out into their fields, in our region, the Calvin grads quickly rise to leadership positions because they actually have capacities of understanding beyond the technical mastery of technician stuff, because they know how to think, how to write, how to imagine, how to read people. And so it's interesting, the sort of package of that. Yeah. I don't know. I feel like I'm not answering your question though. Yeah. My friend Brian Dykeman and I, back in Canada, we also used to dream of what we would call a liberal arts college of the trades. Because I also think one of the regrets is that the liberal arts somehow just got tied to kind of professionalization. Or why should we think that only people who are going to university should pursue the liberal arts? There's no reason why the liberal arts shouldn't just be woven into all formation. And I think the church should be especially invested in that. So yeah, it's interesting to think about. Mostly what I'm worried about is the instrumentalization of education, in which you're not prizing education in itself. You're just stepping through it as a hoop or on it as a rung to get somewhere else. And that's not the pursuit of wisdom. Yeah. Thanks, everybody. It's been fun. Appreciate it.